I'm still Mary Pearl. A lot of thanks, too, to Martha and her committee for the nice luncheon and for the great accommodations. Okay, we're on step five. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. We admit to God for forgiveness, to ourselves for awareness, and to for someone else for humility. For humility. It's another ego deflation step, just as steps one, two, and three are. I can't, God can, think I'll let him. Now, what part have I played in my own misery? Here we are at four, you know. I told him, you know, why do we have to tell somebody else? Well, I don't know about you, but if I didn't have to confess and tell somebody else and be accountable from that point forward, I would just forget about a lot of this stuff and let it go away. Because time and again, over the course of my life, I have looked back at my life at various things and go, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I did that. I probably didn't do that. God, I hope I didn't do that. You know, and I can minimize stuff and justify and rationalize anything away. But once you say it out loud and you tell another person, it's out there. It is out there. You know, and guess what? The world still turns. You know, I thought, well, when I tell this, this is going to freak them out. They're going to throw me out of Al-Anon because I enjoyed sort of being the worst of the worst. If you can't be the best of the best, go for the worst of the worst, you know. And when I got through with doing my first inventory after, well, not the very first, after the first real inventory, where I was answering all these questions and really taking a look at myself to find out the truth of myself, I had tremendous guilt because I could no longer blame. That was one of the things I was told in the instructions. You are not allowed to blame. You can't say, I did this because they did that. In other words, all you can say is, I did this, you know, because the bottom line is nobody makes you do those things. You have choices. The fact you didn't know you had a choice has nothing to do with it. You did have a choice, everyone. And see, that's what I found out when I got here, that some people made a lot better choices before they got here than I did. And I had to accept the fact that, hey, I'm an impulsive person. And I am an obsessive compulsive person. And I never do anything just once. You know, I mean, I have to do it again and again and again. And I get tickled sometimes. I had a girl that sponsored that left the program, and she came back about 10 years later. And I'm always grateful. We call these people who go quit and come back, we call them retreads. And I'm always glad to see the retread coming because if for no other reason, they prove to me it's not any better out there. You know, they usually look like a lot worse shape than they did the first time they come because you've got to hit another bottom before you're willing, and especially when you've been a dropout, to be able to come back in. And so I've always been grateful for them, so they've kept me in. So I don't have to go back out. I can look at them and tell. I don't want to go back out there. But she says, the people here are still saying the same things they did when I left. And I said, and they're still here living life on life's terms, and they're not looking like dog meat. She said, you got a point there. I said, you have to go back out there. You can't listen to experience. And I said, the reason we do this, you go to meetings and you hear the same things again and again and again, is I believe when you went to school, you didn't sit down in your first reading class and learn to read. You had to hear words again and again and again. And I said, and what they mean to you when you first came in will mean something a lot different further down. I said, they grow in depth, they grow in meaning. And I said, you will be sure every inventory you take, you're going to find something at a different level within you that maybe that you didn't realize was as much a problem as it is, because we have a tendency to gloss over things. And I said, and after a while, if you peel onion layer after onion layer off, you're going to get down to the core of you and find out that, yes, that I am that kind of person. I have the ability to be that kind of person, but I can change and be a better person. And I said, it will take a little while to do that because you don't get here overnight. You don't meet an alcoholic one day and end up in Al-Anon the next. That's very unusual, let's put it that way. We had a girl to come to our group one time, and she said she advertised for a mate in the newspaper, and she found an alcoholic. And I said, I'm surprised. They must have been wrapping it around their bottle at the time. I can't see them reading the personal columns because there's always enough sick Al-Anons out there to find one. You know, I love it when the AAs come to the Al-Anon meetings searching. You know, they're looking for a caretaker, what have you. Well, and don't we look for people to take care of? Because when I got here, my self-esteem was involved in being needed. I needed to be needed. And that was where I got my self-esteem. And that's what I found out. So when I completed this first inventory and I had all this guilt, the lady that I asked to do this with me, I thought, oh, she's just going to be terrified, and she's going to run from the room, and she's going to be all those things. But like I said, she wasn't like that at all. And I had tremendous feeling of being one of after having done a fourth and fifth step. It seemed like to me I became part of the group. Other people had done these things, and they had survived. As far as I know, it's nowhere on record anyone has succumbed while doing a fourth and fifth step. You know, and I'm sorry, but no one goes, oh, my God, did you do that? You know, I've never known anyone to do that. They might have thought that, but they never did that. You know, and I loved one of the girls in our group. When she finished her inventory, they tore it up and burned it, and she cooked a hamburger over it. She said something good was going to come of that. So I think that's funny. But the bottom line is we got on our knees and we prayed before we started that fifth step. And she prayed that God would help me to be able to tell the truth and to be honest and to accept what I had heard. And for everything that would come of this would be of benefit to me at some point. And then when we finished, we got on our knees and I prayed and asked God for forgiveness for all of those things that I had done. And I asked God to make me whole. And when we got through, she handed me a plain piece of white paper, and she says, now, you have a clean sheet to write on. You can put that in the past, and the past may never hurt you again, and you don't ever have to bring up anything from the past again that has caused you pain unless you choose to share it with someone else to help them. And you know, the thing about it is, once it was out, it lost all of that power it had over me. I didn't feel like the world would come to an end if somebody found out, because somebody had and the world went on. You know, it was like it sets you free. And in the big book, it talks about that you're creating an arch with which to walk through as a free person. You know, you don't have to be bound by all that garbage of the past anymore. It sets you free. And, you know, all my life, I can remember as a kid when I played jacks and you throw a rotten hand, you yell, over. And that's what I wanted to do with my life. So many times I would call it starting over. A different place, different people, and guess what? It always got in the same snafu before it was over with. How does that happen? Because nothing was any different. I kept doing the things I knew to do. I didn't have any new information. And here you come and you learn, and by working the steps, you get new tools and new information that will help you to create a better kind of life than you have ever dreamed possible. It's amazing. Instead of following the directions, I sat down and waited for perfection to happen. You know? The only thing about now, when you finish the fifth step, you're also given the curse of Al-Anon. And the curse is awareness. The things that you used to do and didn't think anything about, now you have awareness. It's like, oh God, I just told a lie. I heard myself tell a lie. Why did I tell a lie? Because it's more habit to tell a lie than it is to tell the truth. Oh, why did I do this? Because nothing has changed. You're just aware. It's like bringing stuff up to the surface, but nothing has changed. You still have all the ability to do those things that you had. But now you have the awareness, and awareness will haunt you. I mean, it's a bad booger, you know. Over the years, I've done many fifth steps with people, and that's one of the greatest honors that's ever been given to me for someone else to share their life with me, to trust you enough to open up the dark corners of their life and to share those things with you. And a closeness and a bond develops because of that, you know, because there's someone that knows everything there is to know about you and loves you in spite of those things. You know, it's like one of my favorite things is to tell somebody I can love you more because I know you better. You know, it's a freedom. Now, I want to caution you here. Freedom does not come, and relief will not come from confessing the sins of others. Be surprised how many people go to do a fifth step and want to blame everything they've done on somebody else, you know. And I just tell them, you know, that's not an inventory. Sorry, that's not your inventory. That's somebody else's inventory. And we have to start over. Now, we don't take all that out. And when I was writing my fourth step, I was told that if I see something and looking back over it that isn't true, not to destroy it, but just put a line through it and write what the truth is. And I had to do that several times on same thing, every time I'd look it over. And one of those things was the fact that I had had an affair when I was married the first time. And I said to myself, well, the reason that I had the affair, see, you have to have reasons. You can't just say I had an affair. You have to have a reason that's acceptable to you. And so I said, well, I noticed that when we were overseas, how many of the men that were there without their families made use of the girls locally and dated and had affairs. And so I felt like that since my husband got there several months before I did, that he probably did the same. How could he do that? How could he do that? Well, with my belief system of revenge, I was entitled to have one too. Now, wasn't I, according to that? Now, see, I never even thought like that till I'd already picked him out. And so now you have to start justifying why it's going to be okay to do what you know you're going to do. But you got to do it so you can live with it. And the thing about it is every time you compromise one of your beliefs, not somebody else's, but every time you compromise one of your beliefs, your self-esteem goes down, down, down. You know, if you believe that you should never tell a lie, when you tell a lie, your self-esteem about yourself is going to go down, down, down. You're compromising your own belief system. Now, when I was growing up, I had the idea that I was going to get married and I was going to have a family and I was going to live happily ever after. Isn't that what you do as a little kid? And so I got married. I was not happy. I got married. Why did I get married? To get away from home. Why? Because I hated my mother. I wanted to get away from her. Well, you know, nowadays kids just run away. Well, you know, back in my day, the only way you left home was at the college degree or an MRS degree. That's the only two ways you got away from home. There were honorable ways to leave home. A woman living alone in an apartment, hussy. You know, I mean, that was how I grew up. And so, therefore, I couldn't go that route. So I had to get married. And so my mother's great fear was, my mother was always hung up about sex a lot. And she was so afraid that I would get pregnant and not be married, and that would reflect against her. If she had been a better mother, that wouldn't have happened. Well, I wasn't doing anything. Made you want to, though. To get even with her, you know, for all that stuff. But anyway, I got married, and then, like I say, children didn't come along, and I was feeling less than. And my mother said to me always, she said, you should have been a boy. Why should I have been a boy? Well, because there's nothing feminine about you. Well, thank you for sharing, Mother. Okay, I am living away from home. I'm married about a year. And then there was an article in the paper about a Christine Jorgensen. Now, I don't know how many people here remember this, but this was the first person that ever had the sex change operation. And they were from like Switzerland, someplace over in Europe, seems like, or Sweden, somewhere. And so I thought, that's what it is. I'm a man in a woman's body. That has to be what it is. So I have all this confusion going on around me. And so when I met this gentleman, and he gave me a look, and that look was like, woof. And I thought, waha. And then I realized, no, I was not a man in a woman's body. Definitely a woman here. And he's definitely man over there. And you know when you look at one another and you know what they know and they know what you know, that look, the affair has begun. Now, if you don't take action immediately, the affair has begun. And so when I was having to look at this inventory, I looked at it and I said, well, since my husband probably ran around them, and I thought, lie. And so I thought for a little more about that, and I prayed, and I said, God, what is the truth? And the truth was I did it because I wanted to. I wanted to do it more than I didn't want to do it, or I wouldn't have done it. Because what we want to do the most, we do. It's that simple. So I took responsibility for what I had done. I took the responsibility instead of blaming someone else. And you know something? I felt freer on the inside because I had owned up to what I had done. And the reason you tell one person, you know, there was when I came in, a lot of people weren't doing four steps back then. And one of them would say, well, I've told the group my inventory. I've told this at this time and this at this time and this at this time. And I looked at that and I thought, bull. That's nobody knows the whole story. A little here, a little there, a little here, a little there. This is where one person knows everything. It's a true, true thing to let one person see the total of you instead of trying to keep the illusion in that person that you only did this or only did that. It's just a way of not being honest with yourself. And it also tells us, don't take your inventory with a family member. You have no right to dump your garbage on other people. You know, it's like when you're in the picture, you can't see the picture. Someone outside the picture can see the whole picture. So that's the reason it's nice to have someone to do that with. After that fifth step, I felt clean. I felt closer to God. I felt like I deserved God's love. I had that feeling. And I know feelings aren't necessarily facts, but I needed to have that feeling that I was worthy of God to love me. Because see, up until that point, I was pretty much saying, God loves me because God's God, because I'm certainly not worthy. And now I looked and I went, wait a minute, I'm not a totally bad person. Every bad person has done good things. Every good person has done bad things. I think what I am is a human being. Just a human being. And it's just enough to be. It's okay. And that's where we say in this fellowship, we're a fellowship of equals. We're all just children of God. We're all God's kids. And I accepted the fact that I was a child of God because I was made by God and I was worthy of God's love, if for no other reason, because He created me. And it didn't make any difference what I'd done. I had seen people who had kids. And the people that had kids, some of those kids are doing terrible, terrible, terrible things. And no matter what, they may hate what the kids are doing, they still love the kid. And I thought, that is so neat. That must be the way that God loves me. Because you see, I never felt my mother loved me no matter what I did, good or bad. But I always knew my dad loved me no matter what I did. And so that told me that that was a God kind of love, that no matter what you do, God loves you. And I felt like a real Al-Anon because I'd been working the steps. I'd done my part. I had done my part. And I felt a part of instead of apart from. The tragedy is to sit in a meeting of Al-Anon and be isolated within your meeting, feeling that you're not a part of the group, that you don't belong. And if you don't have a home group, for God's sake, get you a home group, a place where that you are there on a regular basis and that you see people and you let people get to know you. Remember, it is Al-Anon family groups. We are a family. We are not just a meeting. We are a fellowship. In fact, my home group knows me better than my natural family ever would have known me, because I could be more honest with them than I could be. You know, I can remember the first Christmas, this newcomer came in, and we were talking about all meeting Christmas night, and she said, "Y'all come to meetings on Christmas? Oh, God, you need one more then and ever, because you've been with family." You know, now you're with people who understand you and who accept you and don't ask you to have to do anything. You know, and that isn't always true in a natural family. There's expectations and stuff. But in your Al-Anon group, everybody is the same. It's talking about here the exact nature of your wrongs. And those are the defects and shortcomings which stand between you and your usefulness to God and your fellow man. That's what it's all about. What are the things that are within me that stand between me and my use to God and my fellow man? Those are the things that I need to get rid of. And so we move on into step 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Like I said, I got to this point and I sat down and rested. I mean, taking that inventory was traumatic, to say the least. It took me a couple of months to get it all written down. Pray about it, go back over it time and time again, get it right, and tell the truth, go over it with somebody, and I think I've done a lot, and I didn't realize that I had a defect, and it was called procrastination. That's a 4-syllable word for sloth. You know? Being a slug, just, you know, sitting there. And it's like, I read everything in the books and there wasn't that much to read about the sixth step. What do? You know, there was just a paragraph in the big book about it. There's just so little, you know, and I have to make a production number out of anything, even brushing my teeth. Let's make it a big deal, you know, and I can complicate things. I have a tendency to do that. I can take a little bitty something, like I say, blow it up, and then you know what to do with it. And my sponsor told me, she said, it's a problem with very educated people. They're usually educated beyond their level of intelligence. Okay. And that's the truth. You know, I sat in meetings for probably a couple of years, and one night the Serenity Prayer came through, and I understood what it was about. Now, I've been praying it daily. Many times a day, sometimes. God, grant me the serenity not to kill that some bitch. I want to. You know, I would go through all that, and every meeting we'd, you know, start with a serenity prayer. But I was sitting there, and it was in an open AA meeting, and when they said, "God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference," I said, "That's it. That's it." It just hit a nerve. We're asking God to give us serenity. We're asking God to give us courage and God to give us wisdom. You see, I had knowledge, but I didn't have wisdom, because that comes from God. It's the ability to take knowledge and use it wisely. And I didn't know how. And no, you don't know how. God is the one that shows you how to do that. And that's what I had been asking for without realizing, because I kept trying to work on it. To do it myself. You work a program, but you allow God to do those things, because those are God jobs. To give you serenity, to have serenity in the middle of a storm when everything around you is going to hell in a handbasket, and for you to be okay. I've experienced that, you know. It's not an everyday occurrence, but it does happen. And all you have to have is for it to happen one time, and you know it's possible. You know, used to, I would sit in my office and my head would be somewhere else. I can't think of the hours of time that I've screwed my employer out of by my mind being somewhere else. My body may be in the chair, but my mind is not there. Did not show up for work today. Sorry. Because I could not turn my head off. I could not seem to turn my head off. And I remember sitting there one day, and it was almost time to go home, and I went, oh, I haven't wondered what he was doing all day today. I have had an entire day alcoholic free. No more free rent in my mind today. It is possible. It is possible. Can't do it every day, but it is possible. And once you find out it is possible, you can do it again and again and again. But you've got to see that it is possible. And that's what the deal is about. Now, the big book will ask you, is your work solid so far? Are your stones properly in place? In other words, have you told the truth? Is everything up to this point? Unto step five, are you ready to start the journey of change? Because, see, nothing basically has changed. You're still the same you. You're doing some different things, but you haven't changed until you become ready to change in steps six and seven. Getting rid of those things that stand between you and your usefulness for God. That's where the change really begins. See, I thought the change was menopause. You think that's miserable, so can this be, I'm telling you. You know, if not, I go back and I try to get myself into the state of willingness to make whatever changes that God deems necessary for me to do so that I can be a useful Mary Pearl. A useful Mary Pearl. It sounds real simple, doesn't it? Well, it's simple, but it's not easy because old habits die hard. You know, and you can say to yourself, I don't want to ever do that. I can remember JD and I would get into the fight. All he'd have to do is open the door and my mouth was attached to it and we'd go at it. Well, just because he's sober doesn't mean this stopped, you know, because you just find different things to fight about, you know, that kind of thing. And so you're going to have a lot of willingness to be able to have the door open and you keep your mouth shut. And it's hard to do, so you have to pray to be willing. So you're going to have to gain some more humility now. You're going to have to be willing to let the other people be right. Oh, I can let you be right as long as I'm not wrong. Well, why can't you be wrong, Mary Pearl? Well, because if I make a mistake, that makes me a mistake, doesn't it? No, it makes you a human being. And when I could learn to say I was wrong and be okay with it, a whole new world of freedom opened up for me. I can make mistakes now. It's not a big deal. Everybody does. But I couldn't allow myself to make mistakes. I couldn't allow myself more often to admit them. But pain is your best motivator, unfortunately. When you get enough pain, you know, it would be nice if we could change when we see the light. But most of us have to feel the heat. You know, just seeing it isn't enough, you know. But when I'm hurt bad enough and practicing a particular defect, I become willing to let go of it when I hurt enough. Now, what was my main thing that was bothering me when I came in? Rage. Not just anger, but rage and violence. And I wanted to get rid of that out of my life. I hated people feeling afraid of me, yet I was afraid to let them get too close, but I didn't want to have to go into that rage and that violence anymore. And so I talked to my sponsor about it, and I told her, I said, how do I do this? And she said, well, you become willing that God would remove that from you. I said, and how does that work? She said, you just pray for the willingness to allow God to show you another way to deal with your anger. She said, you don't know how to deal with your anger. And I got to thinking about it. All right, how did we deal with anger when I was growing up? Well, I don't ever remember being really, really angry as long as Daddy was alive because I pretty much got my way. But after Daddy died, how we dealt with anger was Mother would beat me and I would cry. And then I found out that if I didn't cry, it got even with her more because it irritated her more if I didn't cry. And so I quit crying when I got hurt. And, of course, that made her beat me more. Now, see, that doesn't make any sense. You know, if you're going to get it worse for not crying, but somehow or another, it was like I won. And that's the way it was in our house. It was like a competition. I won. So I had to realize, what happens here? Well, if I don't deal with my anger, I swallow it down. Now, it's not going away. It's deep inside, and it's going blip, 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 blip. And then I have something else, and I don't deal with it, and it goes down, blip, 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 blip. And you go thing after thing after thing after thing goes in until you're just... And then one day, the one more thing happens that you just... It's the trigger. And it goes down, and the volcano that you have created erupts, and here it all comes. And it just comes out. And it comes out on whoever put the last little blip in. And it may not be anything but the girl at the checkout. You know, and usually it's somebody who is not even responsible for all the blips. You know, it's just that poor victim, that unsuspecting victim out there. And usually somebody that you can get angry with and they can't retaliate. That's the best kind. You know, take it out on somebody who can't get even with you. That's really, really mature, you know. And so I realized that's what I'd been doing. And that by the time that that volcano erupts, I have no control over the volcano now. It's totally out of control because I can't stop the volcano from erupting once it begins to blow. And it's like you open up your mouth and it don't, you're not just talking about what happened, but you're going back and you're getting all that anger from all that stuff relived. See, that's what resentments are about. Resentment, it comes from a Greek word, resentire, meaning to refill. And you refill it over and over and over again until you keep the wound raw. It never can heal over. My mother said to me when I was 14, "You are entirely the biggest disappointment of my life." That's pretty heavy on a 14-year-old kid. And Mama said it to me one time. And I said it in my head again and again and again and again, giving her credit for it. Over and over. My mother says, "To think I got pregnant and wanted to be pregnant and then had you." You know, now these are things from a woman who is very, very frightened, very afraid, has no tools to deal with life. She was raised in alcoholism. All she knows is about hurt and how to hurt. That's all she knows. But I don't know that. All I know is that my mother's told me over and over again that I'm worthless. That's the message that I got. And so I repeated that in my head again and again. And I kept going back trying to do something that would make her change her mind and give me a I love you or you did okay. And that was never going to happen because she didn't know how to do that. But the thing of it is, we never sat down and talked about that. Because, you know, in alcoholism, communication goes. There is no communication. You don't sit down and talk things out. How can you? That's what we tell you to do in here. Reason things out with one another. Talk things out. Let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the loving peace of the program flow in you one day at a time. You know, that's what we're taught in here. But I didn't have that. But I had to become willing to do that. And when I became willing to do that, my sponsor said, "Have you ever thought of counting to 10? I said, "Yeah, 5, 10. Hell, I'm there." She says, "Well, obviously, what you're going to have to do is start dealing with anger when it comes before it swallows down in the volcano." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she says, "Well, when something makes you angry, what do you say?" I said, "Nothing. I just grip my teeth. Because if I open my mouth, I'm going to say too much." And she says, "Well, why don't you just open your mouth and say, 'What you did made me angry.' Not 'You make me angry.' But it's what you did." See, I had a hard time separating people from their actions. And I would hate you for what you did instead of hating your action. And so she said, "Why don't you try doing that?" And so I went around there for a long time. "Boy, that makes me angry. That makes me angry." And you know, when I said that makes me angry, I didn't have to swallow it down, because guess what? By making its statement, I was dealing with my anger. I was dealing with the anger. I was taking the power away from the anger by making the statement, "That makes me angry." That didn't mean you were going to change anything you did. If you did, that was nice. But I needed to say it just for me rather than to swallow it down. And when I would do that, then I found myself screaming less. I found myself being rageful less. I began to be able to deal more with my anger because God was giving me tools to use to remove that rage. Because once the rage is there, the rage is there. So you have to, it's one of those things you got to do a little bud nipping here. you know, stop it before it starts. It's a good step, get ready step. Just like two is a get ready step for three, four is a get ready step for five, six is a get ready step for seven, you know. And remember, no matter how long you've been in, you're going to have desires that are going to go against the will of God. That's just the way we are as human beings. Now, you know, I loved the slow premeditated revenge. I loved it. It was such a rush, you know. I got off on that, you know, thinking of how to get even with you. And J.D., he seemed to be the one that could bring that out in me the quickest. Isn't it funny how the people you love can get on your last nerve the quickest of anybody? You have more patience with a complete stranger than you do the person you live with, you know. And he had this craving for things other than alcohol. And he had a craving for sports cars. Now, I don't particularly care for sports cars. I'm a big woman. Sports cars are very low to the ground. They're hard to get in. And I think he did that on purpose because he didn't want me riding with him. But anyway, and this was back in the days when we wore the big bouffant hairdos, you know. And my hair was very long, and so it was like up in this giant beehive or French twist or something of that nature. And so when I would try to get in the car, there was not a good way. Because like I say, it's like right on the ground. My center of gravity, once it gets down like that, it's hard to get it going. And so I would end up just turning sideways and falling in the car. And once you're in the car, you can pull your feet around. You got plenty of leg room, but it's that getting in and out that's tricky. But getting out, I always manage to get my feet hung in the steering wheel. I don't know how that happens. Now, my husband and I are pretty much the same height, only we are very different in our body makeup. My husband has a very long torso. I have very long legs. He has little short legs, so it's easier for him to get in and out of that car, you know. So, I'm trying to get out, I always got my feet hung in the steering wheel. And I hated the car. I hated it. And so, at this point, we went to buy a car at one time, and I told him, I said, I want a station wagon. He said, I want a sports car. And I said, I'm not having a sports car. He said, I'm not having a station wagon. So, we bought a truck. Nobody wanted that. That's how you give in, don't you see? That's your compromise. Get something neither one of you want, you know. Spend thousands of dollars on it. That's what you do. That's sane, you know. So anyway, by this time, you know, I'm still driving the pickup, and it's a big truck, and he's got this little sports car. It's an MG Midget. Now, I don't know how many of you ever seen one of those, but they were the smallest of the small. Up until these smart cars, I have never seen anything quite like that. But anyway, he said to me, what? Right, it's been a long time ago, right. Well, one morning I said, okay, it's my day off. I'm going to go buy groceries with my girlfriend, so be sure and leave me the pickup. Well, he thought it would be funny to see me and my girlfriend, who weighed around 300 pounds, get in the MG Midget. Now, he wasn't going to be there to see it, but he could put it in his mind's eye, you know. And so that morning when I got up and I looked out there and I saw that car, that made me furious. Because I had specifically asked him not to do that. And I thought, well, he's trying to keep me from having a good time. He's not going to stop me. I'm going to be able to go get my groceries. I'm going to do what I need to do. To hell with him. And so it was in the wintertime. So I get in, I fall in, get my feet in. And I go over there in my coat, heavy coat. And she's standing on her front porch. And she hears me going through the gears as I'm coming over. And she's going... Stand there shaking her head. She says, not going to work. And I said, yes, it will. She said, I can't get in. I said, you can and you will. I am a positive thinker. And she said, and so I explained to her how you just drop out of midair. And once you're there, then you pull your feet around. And so when she dropped, the car tilted back and forth. And I finally got her feet around, and I got the door shut because she had on this heavy coat. And then all of a sudden, I'd do my fall in, get in, and every time I'd shift gears, she had a spiritual experience. Well, getting in is one thing. Getting out is much harder. So I got out, got my feet hung in the steering wheel, crawled out, went around the other side, and I said, come on, Reed, you can get out. And she said, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? She said, I'm stuck. I said, stuck? She says, I'm stuck in this bucket seat. I am stuck. She says, there's suction or something here. And I said, well, you're going to get out. And so I put one foot up on the door and the other one over here, and I'm jerking like this. You are coming out of the car. And when she came all at once and caught me off balance, so she fell on top of me out in the parking lot. Well, there's this guy watching, and he says, Lord of mercy, call a fire department. And I say to myself, am I going to have to whip his butt before I go in the grocery store? So finally we got ourselves up and wallowed around out there, and we went in and we bought groceries. Now, I don't have a clue where I thought I was going to put those, because you know there's no trunk. It's the size of a glove compartment. So we had stuff stacked all in behind us and the seats, all in the floorboard, because that's where we had. And then we had to go through this reverse process, get back in the car. Here we go again. We got a few blocks away and broke the axle. Now, my husband comes home from work and he says, where's my little sugar plum? Where's my car? And I said, it's in a ditch over on School Street. He said, what happened? And I told him, and he said, my God, honey, it has a 500-pound weight allowance. I said, who knew and who cared? That was your problem. You left it. I took it. Forget it. Not my fault. Mm-mm, never. So he said, well, we'll go over and we'll try and tow it home. And so we got over there. Now, it's in the big truck, right? Well, the big truck, it's raining about like it is today. And so the automatic choke was on that truck. And all of a sudden, he began to give me instructions on towing a vehicle like I had just fallen off the turnip wagon. Well, there's one thing that's really irritating, and that is for somebody to give you minute directions on how to do something you know how to do. And so he kept saying, now don't floorboard it. Now don't floorboard it. Now, like, who in their right mind would floorboard a car when you're towing, for God's sakes, you know? And so all I did was I just took my foot off the brake, and there was enough momentum from the automatic choke that it threw him out sideways, broke the chain. Because it's a big truck, and that's a little car. And he came up to the window, and he says, I told you not to floorboard it. And he just called me everything but a human being. So I just sat there and watched him. And I thought, okay, if you're going to wear the name, you might as well play the game. So he broke the chain, so the chain's shorter than it was a while ago. And so he hooked on, and he got in, and I floorboarded it. Now, it whipped him out and a back and across about twice and broke the chain, almost flipped him over. And he got out of the car, and he was hysterical. And he came up there, and he said, and I said, now that's what happens when you floorboard it. Did you note the difference? And he said, oh, my God. Well, now the chain's about four foot long. And he said, don't stop fast going home. If you do, I'm going to go up under the truck. Well, I don't know. Is it obvious to you? It was obvious to me. I can't please him. So I just went home. I didn't bother to stop. Yes, there was a red light. Yes, there was a stop sign. I just didn't stop. So when we finally got to our house, he gets out of the car. He says, he says, I'll never have you tow me again in the echoing corridors of time. And I thought, yes, you will. And when you do, I'm going to remember how you've talked to me. 3 years later, I have my big station wagon. It's 450 horsepower engine. It's a 12-passenger station wagon, and he's still got his little cream puff. And he calls me, and he's out at his mother's, and he says, "My fuel pump's gone out. Will you tow me home?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll be glad to." And when I hung up the phone, I said, "Oh, God, he's mine." Now, the hardest thing is to keep a straight face when you get there. And so I back in ever so serenely. And he still got this little 4-foot piece of chain. He was always going to do something. You know how they're always going to do and never get around, you know. And so he hooked it on. And he says, "Now you'll have to drive pretty slow because I'm pretty close on the..." And I said, "Yeah, I see that." Because when I would look in my rearview mirror, I could not see the front end of the car. I could see his windshield and his face. It was enough. So I went out his mother's driveway ever so serenely over to the main highway where I decided to do 80. Well, you feel a little bit of drag, and I could see smoke coming from his tires where he's trying to put the brakes, you know, but it ain't going to happen with a big car. The big mama's on the road. And I'm coming, and I'm just tearing down the road, 80, 90 miles an hour, and all of a sudden there's three cars in front of me. Pass them. Puppy! His eyes were as big as beer cans. I'm telling you, he was waving and screaming. And I was just, nah! I went 15 miles in 13 minutes. Pulled in my driveway. He got out. He cried like a baby. And he said, and I said, "Don't know how to tow, do we?" And I just looked at him and I said, "Don't you ever criticize my towing again." And he said, "Oh, my God." He said, "That was 3 years ago." I said, "Felt like today." Because, see, I could keep that revenge going in me for a long time, you know. And it's like if you wait long enough, every dog has her day, you know. Now, we laugh. I'd be willing to bet you if you was one of those three cars I passed, you wouldn't have been laughing. And when I think about it, you see, my revenge was I would lose all sense of sanity to get even with you. And the fact that I could have been endangering my life, his life, and anybody who was on the road that day never entered my mind. Never entered my mind. And I tell, you know, I said, like, "Well, God, you know, that's funny. I can look back on a lot of stuff in my life that's funny. But it's not funny at the time. And it can have very serious consequences for doing something." You know, I have been to the prisons and talked, and there's people there doing time for me. They're doing things that they got put away with that I didn't get put away for, you know. I could be one of them, you know, but for the grace of God. So that was one of the things. That was just a coping mechanism, you know, the revenge was. Another thing I was told, I had to give up exaggeration, and I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "That's a lie." "What?" "Well, when you make things bigger than what they are, it's not true anymore. So exaggeration is a lie." "Oh, well, I don't guess I'll have much to say for quite a while over here." You know, because I had to have a big deal. See, like I say, I create a crisis all the time. So I had to do that. I had to give up acting superior because I had a tendency to feel like I was smarter than other people until I got around other people and realized they were living life a lot better than I was, you know. And it was because I was so inferior that I had developed a superiority complex to compensate for how I felt on the inside. But my biggest defect of character was self-centered fear, because self-centered fear would activate all these other things inside of me. It was the activator of all of them. And try to live without all your coping mechanisms, you know. It's like, how do you live without doing all this stuff that you've been doing for a lifetime? How do you live without that? You have to learn to put something in its place. You can't just have a void there. You have to do something in its place. And they had the willingness. And it's also on record that nowhere does it show that anybody's had all of their defects removed forever in a day. So you're not going to become perfect. You're always going to have an opportunity for growth here. It's like when I quit doing something over here, then this one over here seems to get out of whack, or this one over here will go. You know, you're always going to have something on which to work. But you're not going to give up your natural instincts. Those are there. You know, fear is a natural instinct that has been overused. Where my problem was in unnatural fear. See, a natural fear is if I go out here and lay down the road, somebody's going to run over me. Naturally. But to think that somebody's going to come off the road inside the building and kill me standing here, that's not a natural fear. You know, that kind of thing. And you have to strive for progress. Progress. Nobody's ever perfect, you know. We have to make a beginning and keep trying, and that's what this step is all about. I've got to remember, too, that God is a gentleman, and He won't give me more than I can deal with at any given time. Times I feel like He has a lot more faith in me than what He should have when I have to go through stuff. But, you know, anything that happens, God's going to be there with you, and He will not give you more to bite off than you can chew. You will, though. When you think that you're being put upon and you've got more on you than needs to be on you, how much did you put on you? Because God has not been the one to do it. Step 7, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Well, this tells me I can't remove these defects or shortcomings by myself, that only God has the power to do that. You know, and the thing about it is, all I've got to do is be willing to live as if they have been. I ask God to take them and then act as if they have been. Live in the now. You know, go about my business of replacing them with positives, opposites. What is the positive opposites of character defects? Well, if you're a liar, the positive opposite is tell the truth. That's not real difficult, is it? You know, there's just a lot of the things. You know, work on improving your honesty. And I took this step on my knees. There is a prayer, a third step prayer, and a seventh step prayer in the big book. And I reaffirm my spiritual connection each day by saying that third and seventh step prayer to start my day. I made the connection many years ago, but I reaffirm it every day. Keep it fresh in the forefront of my mind that I'm turning my will and life over to the care of God, and I'm asking God to make me of use to Him and to take away the things from me that stand in the way of that usefulness. And then I go about my day. And the thing about it is, this is allowing God the freedom each day to work in my life as He sees fit. You know, in the beginning, I would say to God, okay, God, I'm going to give you this today. I'm going to give you that today. Well, I don't do that anymore. I just give God the whole deal. But I had to come at it little by little. And it's okay. It's okay to do this. And when you're in tune with the will of God, things go a lot easier for you. Now, I my self-centered fears. I was afraid of storms. Now, I didn't know. You say, well, why is that a self-centered fear? Because I'm afraid I'm going to get my butt blown away. They can't be much more self-centered than that, you know. And why am I that way? Well, I was raised in Arkansas. We're in the middle of what is known as Tornado Alley. And we have lots of tornadoes every year. And my grandmother, when it would say, when you'd see storm clouds coming, they would say, it's coming up a cloud, which means there's a big storm coming. And then we would go to the storm cellar. Now, I'd just soon be blown away by the tornado as to go in the storm cellar because it's underground. And we have a high water table, and it would be damp in there, and there would be spiders and sometimes snakes. Excuse me, that's a given, spiders and snakes. Tornado is a maybe. This is a given. And my mother was terrified of those storms. So see, that's a learned fear. That's not anything. Did you know the only fear an infant is born with is the fear of falling? That is the only fear an infant is born with. And the rest of them are pretty much learned fears. So anyway, I had this fear of storms. And I'm going, okay, God, I'm ready to give you up the fear of storms. Now, what normally happens? The storms come through anywhere in the middle of the afternoon to late at night. And JD was working nights, so I was there by myself. I've got two dogs, and I'm watching the television. Now, the moment you become in a where the weather is getting where one of these could be produced, they have what they call the tornado watch. And they put a little tornado down on the bottom of your TV screen and say it's a watch. In other words, be aware a tornado could happen. And then when one enters the county where you're living, it becomes a warning. If they have found rotation in that cloud, it becomes a warning. And then the sirens start, the civil defense sirens, and they blow and they blow. And by the time that you've watched that thing come all the way up on that TV screen over a period of hours, you are so in tune to the storm that you're petrified by that. And when the siren goes off, it's like my nervous system just ejaculates. You know, it's just, I'm just berserk. I am just berserk. And now I've got to get my dogs together and we've got to go to a place of shelter. Well, I don't have a storm cellar. And so they'll tell you to go to an inner room. So I have a small inside closet in the middle because you don't want to be around any windows because most people are killed by flying debris. So you want to get into a small space. So I'm trying to get my dogs. They don't like it. They've been picking up on my energy all day long. The fact that I'm nervous and I'm afraid. So now they're growling and snapping at one another. And I've got to get them in the closet. And I'm in the closet and I'm terrified. And the phone rings. Well, what if I'm killed? I'll never know who that was. So now I got to get out of the closet holding the dogs and tell them I can't talk, I'm in a closet, you know. Just stupid stuff. This is before cell phones, obviously, you know. And I got a newsflash, cell phone is worthless in a storm like that anyway because of all the lightning and everything comes with it. But anyway, so we're in there in that closet and I'm doing this and it's funny, one day it hits me. You know, the tornado has never hit me, although I have been around where they have been. When I was a kid, we had one took the roof off the house. But nonetheless, the fear of the storm gets me every darn time. I don't want to be afraid of the storms. I want to be able to recognize, yes, it's a dangerous storm, but I don't want to be so terrified that I'm like this jangled nut for hours because if something were to happen, I couldn't deal with it because I've already worked myself into a frenzy. So I asked God to remove that. And I would pray that, God, please take away that fear. God, please take away the fear. And so then I noticed that if I didn't have the TV on and watch that little symbol all day long, I wasn't feeding that fear. I can read. I can do something constructive. I can read some of my literature. I can do something else. I don't have to watch the TV symbol. When the siren goes off, I'm not jangled because I haven't precipitated that all day long. And so, therefore, I can take my dogs, and they're not in a nervous fit because they haven't picked up off my energy all day long. And we can get in the closet and take what precautions we need to partake. Well, my sister and I have gone out for dinner one night in a nearby area. And while we were in there, it came up a storm. And we noticed that when we were going out to the car, it was quite a bit of wind and rain. She had just gotten her hair done at the beauty shop that day. She didn't want to get hers messed up. As you see, mine doesn't mess up. So I said, no big deal. You take the umbrella. Well, she only got a few feet, and the umbrella went wrong side outwards. And when I got over to the car, I was trying to open my car door. I could barely open my car door against the force of that wind. And all this debris and stuff was flying around, and I am getting so aggravated because I'm getting dirty from the debris. And we get in the car, and we go just a little bit, and I said, it's too windy to drive. I'm going to pull over and just wait till this passes. And we had on the radio, and it talked about a tornado on the ground in Sherwood at the Indian Hills exit. I'm sitting at the Indian Hills exit. That debris that was irritating me was part of a church that was coming from a block away that had been hit. A block away. We were out there in that turn tornado. And I said, Dorothy, we have just survived a tornado. She said, really? And I said, well, is that amazing or what? I said, here I am. I've been in the tornado, and I'm okay. I guess I don't have to be panic about that anymore. You know, and it was so funny because, see, I would never known that that fear had been gone until if that hadn't happened. And so nowadays, I don't go into all of that or anything. I can even have the TV on and watch the stuff. But I realize that it doesn't make any difference if I'm in the tornado, if I'm in the hurricane, because I've been in the earthquakes, I've been in the hurricanes, I've been in all of that kind of mess, the volcanic eruptions over in Hawaii. I've been there when they were doing that. And it's like God takes care of me. Either God, you're going to trust God or you're not. It's that simple. Either God is everything or God's nothing. There it is, you know. And so God took that fear away from me. Well, when I was fishing with my daddy as a child, daddy got spider bit one night. And by the next morning, if I hadn't have known who my daddy was, I wouldn't have recognized him. His face was so swollen. It had been a black widow. And so he went to the hospital. He nearly died. And the flesh where he was bit rotted off. And so whenever I would see spiders all my life, I would look at it and say, it's going to eat my face. Because that's what I could relate to as a child, seeing what it did to my daddy's face. And I was terrified. And I said, you know, I live where there's a lot of spiders. You know, I live in the South. We have a lot of insects in the South. And a spider's not an insect, actually. It's an arthropod. But nonetheless, it's a nasty little beastie. And so... And we have from little bitty ones to the brown recluse to the giant tarantulas, you know. And I said, I hate it that I can look at one teeny and it looks the size of a dinner plate to me. Because fear is a magnifier. Fear magnifies things and makes them worse. And so I would scream at JD, you know, come in here and kill this spider. It's the size of a dinner plate. And he'd say, honey, it's the size of a dime. I said, it looks like a dinner plate to me. And I tell him, you know, come go in there and kill it. I'm locking the door till you get it killed and show me a carcass. It's not coming out. And I wasn't joking. I wasn't joking because I was terrified of spiders. And I found that I asked God to remove that from me. And I, little by little, I could take and kill little bitty ones and what have you. You know, and I don't have to be. I can see one now and I can get out of the way and I can knock it down and I can kill it. Before, I couldn't because I knew it was going to get me before I could do something. And so that's a little thing, but it's something that kept me from enjoying the life that God had for me there. You know, that's what fear does. It's a thief that robs you of being able to enjoy life. And then, I don't know how many people here are afraid of the dentist. Nobody afraid of the dentist. Well, thank you for your honesty. I was terrified when I was 9 years old, went to the dentist. I got hurt, and... I just couldn't get over it, so I would never tell them when anything was wrong with my teeth. And so when I was overseas, I had some dental work done, and then it had been 26 years since I had been to a dentist. Now, by the grace of God, I had good teeth, but I was very careful to take care of those good teeth, too, because I didn't want to. But what would happen was, if I had a toothache and I didn't take care of it, after a while you get where you couldn't stand hot in your mouth, and you get where you couldn't stand cold in your mouth, and you get couldn't you stand your tongue in your mouth, and then they'd end up abscessing and you'd lose your tooth. And so I do a lot of travel, and I was reading in a magazine about a nursing homes, and they were saying that people in nursing homes wished by a long shot they had taken better care of their teeth, because so many of them are in there having to gum it up. You know, and I thought, I don't want to be like that. Well, it just so happened this particular day, my mother had called and thought she was having a heart attack, so I grab her and rush her to the hospital, and I'm sitting there in the emergency room, and all of a sudden I realized the filling that I'd had 26 years ago had come out of my tooth. Mother paled in significance. She's just having a possible heart attack. I have a filling. And so the nurse came out in a little bit and told me that it was not a heart attack. She had a hiatal hernia, and it was giving her a problem. But they wanted to watch her overnight, and I'm going, fine, 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 whatever, whatever, you know. And so I'm there, and I'm sitting there, and I'm praying, and I'm saying, God, you know how it is. Oh, God, not my tooth, not my tooth. Oh, God, not my tooth. And I got the phone book there in the emergency room. I'm looking and I'm saying, God, I need help, but I don't have a dentist. I don't have a family dentist. When you don't go 26 years between visits, you don't have a dentist. And so I said, God, I need help. And so I opened up the phone book to the page for dentists, and right there was a half-page ad. We cater to cowards. Hot damn, that's my kind of dentist. And so I called and I said, you know, I got hurt when I was 9 years old. You know, we have to tell them everything, you know. And the girl said, can you come right now? Right now? Right now? And she said, yes. And I went, oh, God. Well, see, God knew if I waited, if I didn't go right now, then I would chicken out and then I'd end up losing the tooth. And so God provided me a first-time person to call a dentist, a family dentist, and get in right then. So I got in my car and I drove over there and I stopped the car and I got out and there was an arrow that said, "We cater to cowards," going upstairs. And I looked, I'm right across from the freeway, and I thought, well, I can throw myself in the freeway or I can run up those steps. It's 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. Okay, God, please go with me, go with me. And so I got in there, and she knew who I was immediately. I don't know how she knew the fact that I was, hello. And so she gave me this form to fill out. I couldn't tell you my date of birth. I mean, I was that terrified sitting there. I was shaking so hard. And, you know, the irony to this is that we had had dental insurance through my husband's office for years for his company, and I had never gone because I was afraid. And so anyway, I managed to fill out that form. I had to look at my driver's license to find out what my date of birth was. And I got it filled. And all of a sudden, though, I listened to the music that was coming in the office, and they were playing an FM station. And the woman who was the disc jockey on the FM station is one of my grandbabies in sponsorship. And when I heard Ann's voice, it was real common to me. And I knew it wasn't a mistake, that I had asked God to go with me, and God had put something familiar in a really terrifying place. And so I heard Ann's voice. And then they called me to go back into the office there, and I thought, oh, my God, because the last time when I went, dental chairs looked like a barber chair with a tarantula hanging over the top of it. And you see, that gets spider too, you know. And instead, though, it was a nice little chaise, and I'm looking out the window at the golf course. And they had these light panels up on the ceiling. And over the top of the light panel was a poster. And it said, "God, grant me the serenity." The serenity prayer God put right over my head in a terrifying moment that I got very, very calm. And the dentist came in, and he's a very soft-spoken man. And he said, "I understand that you're really afraid." And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "They've made a note," and I looked on my chart, it says super chicken. And he said, "We do a lot of children, and we do a lot of people who've had bad experiences." And he said, "You just touch me if you're uncomfortable." And he said, "We're not going to hurt you." And somehow or another, I believed him, and he didn't hurt me, and I've been able to go to the dentist ever since. You see, God took away that. And it's like now when I get a little bitty something, I call him, I go, "This Mary Pearl, I got to come in right now." "Well, we don't have an opening right now." "Well, you had an opening when I needed you before. You better create one." You know. But anyway, I was able to do that. I had a fear of height, you know. I had all like that. And so it was so funny. When I became to get rid of the fear of height, the first time I went to see the Grand Canyon, I crawled on my belly like a snake and looked in. And said, "Yeah, it's nice." Backed up. It's the best I could do. And I've been privileged to go there and speak. They have a conference over there over the years about 3 times. And I've been able to dance around on that edge now. But how that came about, I asked God for help. I said, "I want to be able to see and do things like normal people do, where I'm not afraid that when I'm standing up, that I'm going to be pitching forward, you know." And so for Christmas, the people I sponsored gave me a hot air balloon ride. They gave me this big certificate for my hot air balloon ride. I finally got around in June by a lot of prayer, and I made an appointment with a guy. And so the whole group came out for the ascension. And had a video camera, and I said, "I want a picture, you know, of all this." And so the funny part about it was one